questions on anything connected with all ports theory?
Pete, how is a functional functional equivalence enable stimuli to account for more things?
Well, functionally, a chair is a chair. So. Okay. Stimuli-wise, every chair from every point of view is different. And if you think that what you're really going by is stimuli, and they're always different, then you need some way of accounting for how come a certain group of stimulus patterns get treated in the same way, namely as chairs. And since there's nothing in stimuli themselves or stimulus patterns that could generate equivalence among stimulus patterns, you need something else of a theoretical sort to do it. And the something else you have is the trait. And that's one of the things that a trait does.
But how did you do that?
Don't ask. See, it does it by magic.
Okay. I like magic.
You know, that's like asking, how does the unconscious produce a distortion of reality? There isn't a way of doing it. It just does it. Yeah. Yeah, remember the definition of a trait. It renders stimuli functionally equivalent forms of adaptive and expressive behavior. So you have the same problem on both the cognitive and the performance end of this equivalence.
How does just words like that? They seem to be useless. They're not very useful to me. Just having a group of words rendering stimuli function equivalents.
Well, look. Take a schema like that. This is a schema for the classical syllogism. And it gives you a schema that says A implies B, A therefore B. Now, what does something like that do for you? Well, there are various ways of talking about what it does for you. The one I have in mind is that it has been called an inference ticket, a license to draw conclusions. You can substitute things for A and B, but as long as you have this much, you can draw this conclusion. Now, the schema itself doesn't tell you anything. It simply licenses you to make certain kinds of moves. It legitimizes certain kinds of moves, like starting with ingredients of this sort and winding up with something like this. Well, likewise, a theoretical thing that you might say operates by magic. It itself is not explanatory. What it does is it licenses you to make the corresponding moves with content that you have in mind.
Got it. Could you say something about trait as a motivational concept again? So I'm unclear as to how it is a motivational concept.
Remember, one of the features of a trait is that it initiates equivalent forms of adaptive and expressive behavior. And
okay,
initiation
and
is.
Get back to that thing. So if you get it, the one step would be asking how a trait initiates, going back to that.
Yeah. You see, it's like asking how does A and B and A produce B? There's no way that A and B, et cetera, produces B. But at this point, given this example of the schema as an inference ticket, you'll see why I talk about these theories or certain parts of them as formulas. Because this is a formula. And a formula, it gives you a form that you follow in doing something. It itself is not a piece of information. So if you keep this example of the syllogism as an inference ticket, and the fact that this is a formula, then when I talk about various theories or parts of them as formulas. You know what I have in mind. And partly it's a polemic that by calling them formulas, I'm explicitly contrasting them to anything informative. This thing doesn't give you any facts. It gives you the form of a certain procedure. So saying traits cause behavior doesn't give you any facts, gives you the form of a certain procedure, namely explaining a particular behavior by reference to a corresponding trait.
Alport seems to treat traits as deterministic. He uses the word determinants. It doesn't seem like one has to do that.
The word determines is ambiguous.
They brought up the question, Alport discussed other crucial questions regarding traits and dispositions. Do they serve to guide or direct behavior only? Or do they also have a role in initiating or instigating behavior? They don't seem to answer here, but I guess that's going back to the motivational role. What does Alport say definitely?
Definition says initiate. Instigate has a little different connotation. The connotation is that of something external. Whereas the relation of a trait to the behavior is, it's not clear whether that is external or internal.
What did you say that was external?
If you talk about instigation rather than initiation, the connotation is that the instigator is external. In the same way, for example, that the connotation of stimulus with respect to response is that the stimulus isn't part of the response, something external to it and prior. In contrast, if you talk about the trait initiating behavior, it's a little more ambiguous as to whether the certain parts of the operation of the trait are just the earlier parts and the behavior is the later part. Or what? Remember, it's a neuropsychic organization that you've got. So it's easy enough to think of the physiological parts as the earlier parts and the visible behavioral parts as the later parts. And then say that the organization initiates the behavior. And that question is simply not well covered.
It's not necessary to say that. Another way to say that would be the trait is, or the behavior is an expression of the traits, and that would not hold any determinant.
Keep in mind, you can't wipe out all of the causal implications there. Because the word initiates, the trait initiates behavior.
Right, Alport would say that, but I was saying it wouldn't be necessary to say that in relation to trait.
It wouldn't be necessary to say that the initiation is deterministic. It might be causal, but not deterministic. Just the difference between deterministic and not deterministic. See, it's like saying, look, I can start sitting in the chair, and there is a difference between my starting to sit in the chair versus my necessarily starting to sit in the chair. And there's a difference between my in fact starting versus it being the case that I couldn't do otherwise but to start. And the differences are not in what you see happen, they're in the framework within which you put it. And one is a framework of necessity, and the other is a framework of fact. You don't need to introduce a framework of necessity.
So the usual cause.
See, keep in mind that necessities are not observable. You can observe something, if something happens, you can't observe that it necessarily happens. So the introduction of necessity is always part of an observer's schema.
The term traded is that enables us to recognize from any angle of the fact that Does he label such a trait?
No, no. These are not cognitive traits. They're behavioral traits. You would want to ask what kind of trait enables us to sit in a chair. And in the course of sitting in a chair, we have to recognize something as a chair, and that's where the functional equivalence of the stimulus comes into play. But also, since we can sit it in a variety of ways, any one of which will do, that's why the equivalent forms of adaptive behavior comes in. So it says the trait is something that sets into motion any of a number of stimulus patterns equally, and any of a number of performances equally. And by saying that it's adaptive, that there's a match, there's some kind of correspondence between the stimulus pattern and the set of performances. Now, what's the nature of the correspondence? Is that the chair is what you sat in.
And it comes out in this kind of language.
See, it's hard, but it's there. But that's part of the point of the exercise of taking some straightforward behavioral interaction and putting it in this kind of language.
Pete, I want to make sure this is what Hall Lindsay describes as a trait. On page 263, they say, although at the same time there is an organizational system that binds together and relates the various components of personality. Is the Bill referring to trait?
Where is that?
On page 263, the second paragraph from the bottom, the second sentence. They say the phrase dynamic organization is common.
This is part of the definition of personality, right? Or the definition of trait. What's the heading? The heading is personality,
yeah,
character,
right,
temperament.
But the way
right above in italics is the definition of personality. And this is an explication of it.
But it seems that
the system that binds it together with that.
It seems to have all the components of the trait. It seems to have all the components of the trait.
That's why when you explicate the theory, you do it in terms of traits. Because the definition of personality is simply the definition of a trait writ large. That's why when you talk about a cardinal trait, you are in effect talking about his personality.
But you say the various components of personality.
Well, remember the kind of things we covered. We covered the self, the appropriate striving. I said those aren't very well connected to trait, even though you use them jointly. In that we appeal to the self to get at consistency over time, including consistency in the trait structure pattern over time. Think of the notion of functional autonomy and the fact that there are various kinds of learning that can produce long-lasting effects.
Right.
Now, those two are not all that well connected in the theory.
But as you point out, it has almost identical structure. And you can see why you need that kind of instructor. If you're going to include things that are not per se connected to one another, you've got to have a covering term whose function it is to connect them. Any other questions? Let me repeat the assignment, which was to do the section of Fritz and Gloria now in all 14 terms, which means essentially trait, but also maybe self. And you can allow yourself reference to traits, attitudes, and values. Now, the reason for doing it this way is that that's the way, in effect, it's done in the theory. See, in contrast to Freud and Alport, where you had theoretical terms that had themselves a substantial complexity. Here you have terms that don't have much complexity, and so you introduce them and then look for the relations between them, rather than having a single term like instinct, and then find that it has four different components and six different variations. That you would call a complex notion. These notions are relatively uncomplex. So we begin with the definition of operant. The definition is an operant is a response that has an effect on the environment. And the historical contrast is between operant and respondent, where a respondent is a response that has a known preceding cause. So the respondent corresponded to the tradition of what you might call Pavlovian conditioning, where you were dealing with a stimulus that reliably produced a response to begin with, and then through a conditioning procedure, the stimulus would reliably elicit a different response. In both cases, it's a case of a stimulus preceding a response and generating that response reliably. It's in contrast to that, you have a definition of a behavior not in terms of what precedes it, but in terms of what comes after it. So the definition, an operant is a response that has an effect on the environment. Now, you elaborate the notion of the effect with the concept of reinforcement. The reinforcement is defined as a state of affairs or an effect which changes the likelihood of the occurrence of the response. We put these two things together, and we're talking about behavior that has an effect where the effect may or may not change the likelihood of the occurrence of that behavior. If that sounds familiar, it should. Remember the instinct where we had behavior, and we said result. So that result may or may not be the satisfaction of the aim. So far, these two notions look very similar to that. An operant is behavior that has an effect. That effect may be reinforcing or not. At this point, you can introduce a taxonomy under the heading of reinforcement. The taxonomy would distinguish one kind of effect from another. And you have at least three major taxonomic categories there, and they are positive, positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, and punishment. Positive reinforcement is an effect that increases the likelihood of the response. Negative reinforcement is an effect that decreases the likelihood. And punishment is something whose cessation increases the likelihood of the response. As you can see, you could introduce other and fancier sorts of notion here, but these are, you might call, the big three. These are pretty much standard in standard usage whenever anybody is talking behavior modification or operant condition. So these are three ways in which an effect can change the likelihood of a response.
Is it true that punishment itself, with punishment itself, you cannot predict whether it will increase or decrease the likelihood of a response? It's impossible to predict.
Remember the definition.
Could you repeat that definition?
The cessation of punishment.
Yeah, the cessation of punishment increases the likelihood of the response that precedes it.
Okay, it doesn't say anything about punishment itself.
Okay. Yeah, if I introduce punishment and never stop it, it's not easy to predict what you're going to do. On the other hand, keep in mind, none of these are predictions. These are definitions.
Isn't negative reinforcement sometimes used to refer to cessation of punishment?
Hmm. As usual, when you don't have a real authoritative structure, people tend to switch usages. And in particular, the notion of negative reinforcement, the term aversive stimulus, and the term punishment, they will have different usages. And if you just remember the distinctions, you'll be prepared to find different usages and it won't throw you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been through this confusion myself because I have to stop and think. And then when I realize why, it's because I've heard it both ways. So the best thing to do is just remember the distinctions and play the term by ear. Well, I don't know. That may be like saying, well, there's no such thing as pure primary process. The fact that there's no such thing doesn't keep it from operating in a theoretical formula. See, probably what's happened is you find that you can formulate anything that you can formulate by direct reference to this, you can formulate in some other way. And then if you prefer to do it the other way, then you say, well, there really is no such thing. I'm reminded of some historical example. There really no such thing as forgetting. It's really interference instead. Expect that kind of thing in theorizing. Okay, let's consider a behavior. So far, we've just introduced a crude notion of changing the likelihood of the occurrence of the behavior. The next point is, what behavior? And the answer is any behavior that's like the original behavior. If this is the behavior that got reinforced positively, then the behavior whose likelihood increases is not just this one, but anything that is similar enough to it. Now, take an example, a classic example. Here's a box with one wall with a red dot on it, and in the box is a pigeon, and the pigeon pecks the red dot and he gets a positive reinforcement. In terms of the definition of reinforcement, see, picking the red dot increases in likelihood. Observationally, what happens is it's not merely picking the red dot, pecking the red dot, that increases, it's pecking anywhere close to the red dot. Furthermore, the closer to the dot, the greater the increase in likelihood, and the dot itself has the highest increase in likelihood. So you get the picture of the specific behavior increasing in likelihood and pulling along with it any similar behaviors. Now, since the principle of reinforcement doesn't encompass that, we need a new term, and that new term is generalization. And this generalization is response generalization. The principle of response generalization says the changes in likelihood of behavior occur not merely with respect to the behavior in question, but also with respect to similar behaviors and to the extent that they are similar. Now, you'll note here a potential practical problem of which behaviors are similar to which. And as you might expect, very often you have to do it backward. If you have a behavior that is unlike the one that you reinforced and you want to know, is it similar enough? You wait and see if its likelihood increases. If it does, you say, yeah, it was similar enough. If it doesn't increase, you say, no, it wasn't similar enough.
So you can't say how much is similar enough.
Enough. That's right. Now, let's introduce the notion of contingency, because the statement, the initial statement was clearly incomplete. Saying that reinforcement changes the likelihood of the occurrence of the behavior leaves out one important factor, namely likelihood of occurrence when, where. And somewhere between implicit and explicit in the original principle of reinforcement is under the same conditions in which it occurred. If this behavior is reinforced, what changes is the likelihood of the occurrence of the behavior under the same circumstances. Well, they're going to have to be, it's going to have to be the reinforcement. I was going to say they're going to have to be the same, but they don't. You could have the same behavior elsewhere, not reinforced.
Is the notion of contingency generalization?
Yeah.
Similar.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's completely parallel. Having said that the likelihood of occurrence in the same circumstances will change, we now amplify to say in the same or similar enough circumstances. And to the extent that they are similar. And here there is another classic paradigm. In which instead of just a red dot, this is a red light. And that red light has a presumably well-known wavelength. And you shine the red light on there, and then the pigeon pecks it and you reinforce positively. Then you shine a light that is not the same color, but close, the wavelength is close. And lo and behold, pigeon is more likely to peck with that light than he is, say, with a wavelength out here. And in fact, if you count cumulative frequencies, you get a nice curve that looks like this. Namely, the likelihood of responding plotted against the wavelength of the light that he's responding to. So if you reinforce this, you get a nice something like a normal curve with the wavelength that was reinforced at the center and being the greatest increment. And then the likelihood tapering off with wavelengths that get further and further away from the reinforced wavelength. This is very nice because it also presents you with no problem as to what kind of similarity you're dealing with. You're dealing with similarity of wavelength. And as before, as I said, you can expect some problem if you actually had to decide what behaviors were similar enough. If you don't have anything as neat as this, you also have a problem as to what circumstances are similar enough. But the principle of reinforcement tells you that you get this kind of effect. Now, again, this should look familiar. What we have here is the analogs of Allport's two equivalence clauses. This group of stimuli that were whose likelihood was all changed by the reinforcement, in effect, are functionally equivalent. This set of behaviors whose likelihood was increased are the equivalent forms of adaptive or expressive behavior. There is this difference that in the operant conditioning tradition, you have this kind of an effect. You have a quantitative falling off. It's not that everything within a certain bundle is equivalent. You have more or less equivalence depending on degree of similarity. So it's not quite the same, but you can see that it's analogous. And that it probably, these two generalization is doing pretty much the same thing within operant conditioning theory that functional equivalence is doing within Allport's trait theory. CJ, did you have a...
Yeah, it is non-accidental, but you have to go way back for the reason. The reason is that when you have clear-cut situations like these and have a very repetitive response, then you can indeed count frequencies and talk about probabilities in that sense. On the other hand, when it comes to many of its extensions in clinical use, you're not counting probabilities. You don't have a repetitive thing. What you're going is on the notion of likelihood. That if I do this, this is likely to happen. And you haven't counted cases, you're not talking about probabilities, you don't have a probability, but you have a likelihood judgment. So probability is a very specialized notion, and within very specialized situations, it has a direct and legitimate application. Within other situations, the application is either indirect or illegitimate. Okay, now let's add something else to the notion of contingency. So far, what we've got is the notion of operant, reinforcement, the result of reinforcement, the more general results of reinforcement, the various possibilities of that sort. Now we come to an additional thing here, which is an elaboration of the, it will occur in the same circumstances, namely that if for a given behavior,
reinforcement, just to simplify, I'll put it all always in terms of positive reinforcement and simply make whatever changes you need to encompass other kinds of reinforcement. It gets pretty cumbersome to try to always carry them all with you. If reinforcement occurs only in certain, under certain conditions, which we will call the contingencies, then it comes to be the case that only under those circumstances is the likelihood of that behavior increased. So for example, if we have this pigeon pecking the red dot and the reinforcement is a grain of wheat, and then out here I have a triangle and I can put a blue card there so that the triangle looks blue, or I can leave it blank. If I give him the wheat only when he pecks when the triangle looks blue, after a while what you'll find is a lot of pecking when the triangle is blue and a random level of pecking when the triangle is blank. Now, this is simply a special case of the general principle that with reinforcement, the likelihood of the behavior increases under the same conditions. Well, if the reinforcement only occurs when this is blue, then the likelihood of the behavior when the thing is blue is increased. But the likelihood of the same behavior when the thing is not blue doesn't increase. Now, at this point, you have a theoretical problem of opposing tendencies. And so we have notions of discrimination. I guess for that we need the notion of extinction. The notion of extinction, we say, if a given behavior is not reinforced in particular circumstances, the likelihood of that behavior will go down.
Talk about the behavior as inclusive of the contingencies. When you're talking about reinforcement, is that always necessarily so? It would seem so. But when you talk about a behavior which is being reinforced, contingencies are automatically inferred.
No, that's here. You know, again, come back to the stimulus generalization paradigm here. Remember, a wavelength and then responses to different wavelengths. Now, suppose you do this kind of experiment. You say, okay, I'm going to reinforce that pigeon for pecking at exactly this wavelength and anything in this region. But if he comes out here, I'm not going to reinforce it. And then see what happens. Well, what happens is that you have extinction here and generalization here, and the net effect is that at a later time your curve looks this way. Because you've extinguished here, you've reinforced only there. So by selective reinforcement, you get finer stimulus discrimination. By selectively reinforcing and extinguishing, you get finer discrimination.
But that's based on between
reinforcement and extinction.
Why is the bell narrowing?
Because you've extinguished here by not reinforcing.
But that happens in the lowercase too.
No. If you give a single reinforcement, this whole thing goes up.
Okay.
But if trial after trial, you only get reinforced here and not out here, then the curve changes in that direction.
So you're talking about the immediate over time?
Yeah, with repeated trials. See, this would be the effect of reinforcement here. You get generalization. And you will get that unless you have selective reinforcement, and then you get finer discrimination.
Is the notion of extinction tied only to the lack of reinforcement? Or can you negatively reinforce and therefore extinguish?
I think that what you have is the influence of both is the same, but you distinguish them conceptually, or you distinguish them theoretically. That a negative reinforcement will decrease the likelihood, whereas extinction, you say, it too will decrease the likelihood, but for a different reason, you might say. That the one is simply the absence of being reinforced, therefore, via a discrimination process, you'll start doing other things, which are reinforced. So it's a non-reinforced behavior competing with reinforced behavior. Whereas with negative reinforcement, there is something that you might say acts directly to reduce the likelihood, and that you don't explain in terms of competition with other behaviors. You simply say there's the connection between this kind of result and the decrease.
That someone that would speak of extinction by negative reinforcement would be speaking sloppily?
Well, it depends on the current norms. It also depends on the context. If he was just talking about how you get something like this to go down, you probably wouldn't count it as sloppy. If he was writing for a journal, the editor might red pencil it. Because of the equivalence of the results. He could say, yeah, I'm extinguishing by negative reinforcement. For example, take something like shocking that pigeon. If you not only don't give him the wheat, but shock him when he does here, you'll get faster results.
The thing is, when you stop the shock, then the behavior comes back. And so it's not the change. Mm-hmm. You stop the negative reinforcement, the behavior
comes back. No. You know, you mean over time, over trials?
Oh.
No. Remember again, we're dealing with definitions, not predictions. If you shock that pigeon for pecking this wavelength and he stops doing it and then you stop shocking him, he may or may not start doing it. And if he doesn't, you say, well, I guess the negative reinforcement was negative enough. And if he does, you say, I guess it wasn't enough. There is no prediction in it. The reason, in part, is that the theory does not specify for you which things are reinforcements, which things are positive, negative, or aversive reinforcements. Any more than Allport schema specified for you which traits people have. So think of this as an inference ticket too. That if you do this, you can legitimately expect and predict certain things, but they may not happen. And if they don't happen, whatever does happen, you can legitimately now describe in these terms. That's you get that flexibility with the word enough. If you negatively reinforce, it's legitimate to expect that the behavior will stop. If it doesn't even decrease, you say, I guess I was wrong. That wasn't the negative reinforcement. As I say, you're dealing with definitions, not predictions. As a matter of fact, maybe we better come back to a historical dialogue on that. The historical dialogue starts with the definition of reinforcement. And then somebody says, but that doesn't tell us which things are reinforcing. That's the first move. The counter move is, well, you look to see what increases the likelihood of this behavior, and that's how you tell that it's reinforcing. So that's move two. Move three, the rejoinder is, but then that's circular. You define the thing as reinforcing on the basis that it increases the likelihood of behavior, and then you turn around and explain the increase in the likelihood by saying, well, after all, it was reinforced. It isn't that about as circular as you can get. That's move three. Move four is, no, you've got us wrong. It's not circular because on occasion X, we noted the likelihood changing, and it was on a different occasion, occasion Y, that we said the thing was reinforcing. So you see, it's not circular. Move six is go back to goal. Because move six is the same as move one. Namely, but now look, if on occasion Y, the likelihood of behavior doesn't change, you're going to say it wasn't reinforcing. So aren't you back to the same position? That finding out that it was reinforcing on occasion X doesn't guarantee that it's reinforcing on occasion Y. Consequently, you're back to the circular definition on occasion Y. Now, that's move six, and the state of the art in the field is at move five. I haven't seen move six in the literature, but somebody will come up with it. Anyhow, you see how this notion of reinforcement and definition versus actual instances and predictions works out. You know, there are some complications, and people think of these things over time, and you find them in the journals if you trace back through the year. Okay, so we have this notion of contingency, which introduces, functionally speaking, a strong selective factor in which behaviors change their likelihoods and under which conditions. Now, in principle, that means that there is no limit to how narrow you can make this. Theoretically, there is no limit. So you have to find out, in fact, how, for different behaviors and different circumstances, how narrow this can be. What you can say is, well, what you're doing is pushing the limits of the individual's capability of discriminating. The reinforcement motivates him to discriminate, but if he can't, he can't. And the better you motivate him, the more you can be certain that he's doing as well as he can. And past a certain point, you say, I guess we're just dealing with species limitations or individual limitations in ability or capability, and there's no point in doing any further selective reinforcing. And clearly there are limits for things like wavelength of how finely you can discriminate, of how different things have to be before, for you, they're different. And just as clearly, practice and experience will help.
If you test different individuals' maximum discrimination, of labeling, tornado discrimination, that's what you want to call it. And you found different individuals had different abilities where that really was. You would then say that, you then wouldn't call it species limitation. You didn't call it individual limitation.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, keep in mind that there's some ambiguity as to when you have tested his limitation. If you take an ordinary test of discrimination, somebody might say, I bet I could improve this by suitable motivational operations. Yeah, give him 10 amps instead of 2. You know, or offer him a prize for being able to read the fourth line. And you know what? It sometimes works. So you're never sure. You have to make practical judgments as to when you've reached what limit. Okay, now we have the ingredients now for putting together a more complex scenario in which you begin with an operant. You reinforce selectively, you get generalization, but you also get discrimination. And ultimately, you have the picture of the response having changed its likelihood under certain conditions, these contingencies. And in fact, imagine a more extreme case in which these conditions are the only conditions, practically speaking, in which it occurs. So that you have a set of such that if you produce these conditions, then that behavior will, again, practically speaking, occur. At that point, you speak a different language and say that the response has been conditioned to these contingencies. The process of conditioning has taken place. What the operant is conditioned to is the contingencies. You now speak of those contingencies as the controlling variables for that response. As a result of selective reinforcement, what you have is the behavior occurring when those contingencies are present and not otherwise, practically speaking. When that has happened, you say conditioning has taken place. The response has been conditioned to those contingencies.
So conditioning is the use of selective reinforcement to mix contingencies controlling variables.
Right. It sounded like.
Yeah, I wanted to a way of making it sound like a definition for condition.
I'm not sure that conditioning gets defined. It gets defined operationally in, you know, these various experimental procedures, and they talk about conditioning, but unless you go back to Pavlov in the early days when conditioning was a new notion and therefore they thought they had to define it. These days, I'm not sure who gives a definition of conditioning.
Say the contingencies become the controlling variable?
You speak of those contingencies as controlling variables. As you change your language, you don't really need this if you were willing to talk in a little more complex way. But calling them controlling variables is an efficient way of saying that a process of conditioning has taken place and that it has had this endpoint. And it's a lot easier just to get that by talking about controlling variables than to give a speech. So the facts are, as we can describe here, the language here summarizes and packages a lot of these. And when that has happened, the behavior in question is no longer just an operant, it's a conditioned operant.
What's the difference what's the difference between being
these two?
When it has the controlling variables?
Yeah. When an operand has been conditioned to a set of controlling variables, it is a conditioned operand.
In the process of conditioning, does the selective reinforcement, is the selective reinforcement used to the extent that the contingencies become the only conditions?
That's an extreme case. It doesn't have to be that. I just introduced the extreme case to, yeah. So it's not to suggest certain practical difficulties that do in fact exist.
So there are slightly conditioned operands and very conditioned.
Well, again, you see, when you decide that it's been conditioned enough is when you switch to talking about controlling variables and conditioned operands. Otherwise, you talk about contingencies and operands and reinforcements and so forth. So it works like that definition of pathology. When you decide that the restriction is serious enough, then you stop talking about the usual social things and say he's sick. Sir. So the endpoint of the development of each of these and their relations comes here and above all here. But it's in the notion of the conditioned operand that you get a package that encompasses most of the other notions within operand conditioning theory. Now let's look at the example that Hall and Lindsay give of a case of operant conditioning. And that is giving a kid candy when he asks for it. And presumably not giving it to him when he doesn't ask for it. So you say, well, if you give the kid candy when he asks for it, that's going to increase the likelihood that he's going to ask for it when you're there. It probably isn't going to increase the likelihood of his asking for it when he's all by himself, because that, you know, that's not similar enough to the original situation. But if you're there, even though you're standing in a different place or you have a different posture, etc., probably the likelihood will go up. Because that looks like it should be similar enough. So indeed, that's the way it works out. If you've dealt with kids and candy, you know that they don't care how you're standing or how you're dressed, etc. The crucial thing is that you're there and that you're the source of the candy, and they'll ask.
Is there any notion of the dimensions of similarity in that sense? And in this, for that example, source of reinforcement,
yeah. There's very little work on dimensions of similarity today, as far as I know, except when you're dealing with some things that obviously have dimensions of similarity, like distance, wavelengths of sounds, wavelengths of lights, or degree of curvature, things of size. See, all of those things that have obvious dimensional characteristics probably have by now been explored in these conditioning circumstances. Most of the similarities that you're dealing with in human interactions are not of that sort. And I don't think there's been hardly anything at all done. And there's a reason for that, in that the people who use these theories are very liberal in what they allow themselves to plug in as stimuli or as responses. For example, they have a distinction that parallels some of our form of behavior distinctions. When they distinguish a topographical response versus a functional response. The topographical response corresponds to a performance. And they say, well, you know, the response that is getting reinforced isn't necessarily just a topographical one, it may be a functional one. And then any behavior that has a certain result is that functional behavior, and that's what got reinforced. So because you have this flexibility in what you're willing to allow as a stimulus or as a response, and by adding this classification of topographical and functional, there is not the internal pressure to find stimulus dimensions of similarity for human interactions, because the theory no longer requires that. And since it doesn't, they're not going to go look, given that it doesn't look easy. Well, now take the business of giving the kid candy, and I suppose you'd have to go to eating the candy to find your reinforcement. And asking for it and taking it and putting it in your mouth, maybe, are the instrumental behaviors. The reinforcement is the eating it. You say these kinds of things because it's clear that if all of the others took place but he was never able to eat that candy, giving it to him wouldn't have the desired effect, unless it did. And it might. And then you'd have a different story to tell. Okay, so let's pick the eating the candy as the actual reinforcement, the thing that is reinforcing. And then we go through that dialogue or some form of it and ask, well, is eating the candy always reinforcing? Or we might ask, is it always positively reinforcing? Isn't it maybe sometimes negatively reinforcing? And here the answer is, yeah, come to think of it, if the kid has already eaten two bagfuls of candy and you give him more and he eats it, it probably gonna make him sick. And at a certain point in time, it even stops tasting good. And so if he's at that point, then that candy probably is not going to be positively reinforcing. It may even be negatively reinforcing. Hmm? Say, well, do we have a general principle, at least for that kind of case, as for when the candy is positively reinforcing and when it isn't? And informally, the answer is yeah. It's reinforcing when he's hungry and not reinforcing when he's not. No. You can, if you want, either reduce or analyze the notion of being hungry. You can reduce it to a physiological condition, or you can analyze it as simply a term which connects a variety of antecedent conditions to some later states of affairs. Doesn't really matter, because what you've done is you've distinguished some limited states of affairs from all others, and that's all that's required. You distinguish a limited set of states of affairs under which the thing will be reinforcing and other as against others in which it won't. And so that state of affairs, however you analyze or reduce it, is going to be a contingency of reinforcement, because it will be only under those conditions that eating that candy will be reinforcing.
I was going to say, there are other instances besides hunger and not hunger where it won't be reinforcing, like when you get the toothache or something.
Yeah. We only need one, not two. Maybe a toothache would be better. Let's stay with hunger. No, that's one kind of contingency, that unless something is the case, the candy itself is not reinforcing. Well, there's a different kind of contingency, namely that unless the person is there, he doesn't get the candy. So that's a different kind of condition that has to be met in order for him to get that reinforcement. In one case, it's a condition for getting the candy. In another case, it's a condition for the candy to be reinforced. Now, clearly, these are very general kinds of conditions. That is, the conditions under which you get a thing and the conditions under which, having the thing, it is reinforcing. So you might say that you can also see that both of them are necessary. Without having it, the question of whether it's reinforcing doesn't even arise. But if you have it, then the question of whether having it then, in those circumstances, is reinforcing, that necessarily does arise. So these two kinds of contingencies, you might say, are indispensable in dealing with the general notion of contingency. That is, contingencies couldn't work the way they do in the theory if you didn't have both kinds of contingencies. So when we speak of a conditioned operant as an operant that's conditioned to certain contingencies, we say, in general, the contingencies will be of each kind. It is, eventually it will come to be the case that the child will ask for candy only, number one, when you're there, and number two, when he's hungry. Or at least when he's not full to capacity. Yeah.
Are they all contingencies?
No. This is my elaboration of operant conditioning theory. See, because it involves elaborating the notion of contingency to see, instead of working with the formula notion of contingency, what we've done is we've asked what sorts of things are contingency, are reinforcements, and how does a reinforcement work? And what we find is that you have to have it, whatever it may be, you have to have it, and it has to be reinforcing under those circumstances. So the notion of the circumstances, the conditions of reinforcement, break down into having a certain something, and then that something being reinforcing under those circumstances. Now, do a little historical reflection again. That should sound familiar. Where did we encounter something like this before? In Freud, where? No? That's right. In elaborating the notion of the psychic object, we had to introduce the notion of a particular object that you deal with in certain circumstances in a particular way. That you can't just deal with objects. There has to be something in some circumstance that you deal with in some way. And here we're making a similar move. You don't just have circumstances under which you have reinforcement. There has to be something, some particular circumstance. And whatever it may be, it's not guaranteed to be reinforcing in all contexts. Therefore, the context has to be the right context.
And in a way, that also corresponds to intentional action. The hunger in that sense is the motivation of the person is okay.
Yep, that's what we're moving toward. You know, at this point, we're ready to make this move. See, as I said, the conditioned operant is the operant conditioning notion that packages most of the important notions in the theory into one package. So, if you asked what is Skinner's answer to the general question of why do they do what they do, he wouldn't have a completely universal answer, but he would have a practically universal answer. He would say most of the important things They do because their behavior is a conditioned operant response.
Why do you make that condition that close?
Because Skinner is cagey and he allows us how there are other kinds of conditioning and not all behavior is a conditioned operant. There is also respondent conditioning. But he would be inclined to argue that even respondent conditioning probably wouldn't survive if it was counter-reinforcing, at least to a large extent. So you have that same fuzziness at the boundary. You know, do you push it to the complete limit or do you stop short and say for all practical purposes or for most important cases, et cetera? Remember, we had the same thing with Allport on the degree of unity. I said, well, it sounds like he's kind of playing it both ways. If you pin him down, since he can't show complete consistency, he says, well, empirically, we're not going to find it. But then in a stage whisper, he says, but it's probably there. Well, likewise, you see, with Skinner, you can show him things that don't at all look like operant conditioning. So he'll say, well, no, not all behaviors conditioned operant responses. Then he has a stage whisper that says, but it probably wouldn't last long if it wasn't. So as the major candidate for the answer to that question, you know what we want to compare it to, namely intentional action, since we've done that with trait and with instinct.